everyone. This is the one known to you as Gary, welcoming you to the LL Research Radio Program in the Now, Q&A with Carla and crew. Today is Tuesday, August 26, 2014. Carla L. Ruckert is an author, mystic, and seeker, and primary channel for LL Research. The crew in the title refers to those of us at the LL Center, beginning with Jim McCarty, Carla's husband, scribe for the Raw Contact, and president of LL Research. Austin and I, devoted seekers of the Law of One, manage LL Research from the home office. LL Research is a nonprofit organization dedicated to freely sharing spiritually oriented information and fostering community, and towards this end has two websites, the archive website, llresearch.org, and the community website, bringforth.org. We will be discussing questions that come from you. If you would like to ask us a question live on the air, please call 646-595-2294 and press the 1 key when prompted. When submitting questions, please remember that this is a Law of One Q&A. Try to keep your questions as spiritually oriented as possible. Again, I'm Gary, and we're talking with Carla L. Ruckert and the home crew of LL Research. I presume we're all ready to go.
We're not ready, but we're going to go anyway.
We'll do it.
In which case, then, let's begin with the opening quote from November 18th, 2001. Kuo says, "Each has had crystalline, shining moments in his life when love has become real, not just a word, not just a concept, but amazingly, vividly, powerfully real. Think about those times and the gift that those times have given you. Allow the consciousness that filled you at those moments to come back to you, just to remember how it feels."
When I was in my 20s, I was sitting in my living room, and Don Elkins was getting ready with me for a meditation meeting. He leaned over to tie his shoelaces, and I saw his face closer than I'd ever seen it before. Every freckle, every dear feature. My heart stopped, stuttered, turned over, and I knew in that moment, for all time, that whatever it was that he needed from me, he would have. When I was in my 30s, a new meditator came to the door. I'd met him a couple of times before. He was wearing a juggler's costume, and I got close enough that I could smell the good, healthy sweat that came from his having worked so hard not very long ago, offering his juggling for service for some kids to entertain them. And my heart turned over, stuttered, and stopped. I thought, I like the way he smells, and I knew that whatever he needed from me, he would have. These two relationships shaped my life. I celebrate them now. And I invite you to think back, whether your moments of love are moments as a parent, as a mate, as a lover, as a friend, or even the seemingly dispassionate love of an idea that seizes your heart once and for all. Think on it, dwell on it just a moment, and remember the absolute quality of that moment. There wasn't any doubt. There was no longer any question. It moved consciousness within us to another level, entirely, a level that really cannot be described in a way that nails it down. Finite, it's infinite. There is a spiritual sanctity to such moments. And when we keep them close and dear, when we not only celebrate the moment, but honor it in our life thereafter, blooms and blossoms in ways impossible to have predicted before. These moments are real. Downhearted about life, we can doubt so many things, make fun of them, laugh at our innocence, deny those moments, their absolute positivity and their ability to fill us with unmitigated joy. I don't think we were meant to live our lives on the precipice, the peak feelings. But I do think that there is an abiding joy that comes from being an experiencer of such times and honoring that experience, knowing its reality, never turning our backs on that. That was and is and always will be. I do think that we have the capacity always to choose to lift our wings and fly. Not in a hysterical way, but in the everyday, simple moments of one foot after the other, trudging through life the way we all do. There is joy in that. There is beauty there. I hope you never become cynical, beloved ones. If you never sneer at those innocent moments when love touched you, that wonderful consciousness that knows no bounds. Let yourself walk in those footsteps, not remembering the past. In knowing the reality of it, you know that it's possible now. You simply lift your wings and fly. What are you looking at right now? Pages of a book? See that book and its beauty. Another person, see the Creator and be amazed. A flower, to live like that now, 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 and be joyful. Amen.
And an amen from this end. Thank you, Carla. We have a couple of callers, one of which was first, and I think I know who this is. Is this JP?
It is.
Hello, JP. How are you today?
I'm great. I'm glad you recognized area code 801. Hi, everybody.
One of our favorites.
Last week's show was really, really good, and Carla's talking about choice and pain and catalyst, and I got thinking about that and studying about it. I read the part on free will in Carla's Living the Law of One 101, The Choice, and it really has an interesting section on free will. Carla, I love this book, and I hope that you can do 102 and 3 soon. That's great. But it really kind of, I wouldn't say upset, but I'm really quite curious about your guys' take on your take, and if anybody's ever commented from a hierarchy. This thing about free will, what happens when us human beings put ourselves in a position that where we don't have any choices anymore? We can't act like the person who's seeking the Christhood. Sometimes we're backed in the corner, and there really isn't any very nice way out, or we're put in karmic circumstances that where choices seem to be gone. So are the problems resolved? Are they continued? What should we expect when we get ourselves in a bind? And just as a quick example, if you're sitting in your office floor on floor 89 in the one tower on 9/11 and you see the other building going down, you probably know that your choices now are very limited. And I think us humans get ourselves in this kind of a pickle all the time. Okay. So what comfort is there in any of these terrible outcomes?
Well, it's not a terrible outcome. It's death. And death is a shift to another kind of consciousness. Karmic circumstances are those circumstances which have devolved upon you by your choice before this incarnation. You wanted to work this out. And if you're really faced with it, you wanted to work it out badly. Okay, so you take a good look at it, and you try to find where the love is in this situation. How can you move from judgment to forgiveness? And these choices are all within your consciousness. There's nothing that takes you off the 89th floor of a building that's going to go down. No. You may die. You may have a difficult day. Anything in between the two. But you can always choose your state of mind. You're always free within yourself. I think you need to find that freedom within yourself, and the freedom always lies in finding love, I think, one way or the other. I've been in situations where, oh, Lord, for instance, when my first husband left me for the seventh time, I thought he was gone finally, and I rejoiced quietly and prepared to live a life free of the drama of this strange human being that wanted to be married, yes, no, take your choice that day. He was finally gone. And I could move on. And I was moving on. I was moving on at a high speed. I was up in Boston. I just accepted a job with the Boston Public Library, second oldest library in the United States. I'd gotten a job as a children's librarian, teaching kids mostly with English as a second language for them. It was going to be just a delicious job, a challenging job, wonderful job. I was looking for an apartment with my mom. She'd come up to Boston, and we were looking in Cambridge. I love that old town and the old houses that are so much like old Louisville, and I feel very, very much at home there, the way I grew up. Anyway, I get a phone call from my husband, and he says, I'm not going to give up my lover, but I can't find a job, and I need you to take care of me, so you're going to have to come here and take care of me. I ask you, person to person, I would say man to man, except that raises obvious questions. What do people of honor do when they're right back against the wall? I looked at my promise to this man, which I had made in good faith. And there was no small print, let's see, for better or for worse, rich or poor. No small print there. I gave up my job. I gave up the apartment. I gave up my dreams. And I headed up to Vancouver to sit on the sidelines and get a job and support this young man, which is what I had done for all 4 years of our marriage. I loved that job. And until he presented the next horrible thing to me, I was in good shape mentally, emotionally, and so forth. And it wasn't that I skewered myself out of the corner by any cleverness. I just doggedly fulfilled my responsibilities. But there was room in there for joy. There was room in there for the quiet peace that comes when you know that you were doing the very best you can to honor those promises made and to be a person of honor and to live life the high road. I've always believed in living by the high road if I could possibly find a way. And there is always a way. You can choose the higher path. So I guess that's my answer to you, that the changes in free will are sometimes all within consciousness. But it's within consciousness that our true life exists. It's within our consciousness that we can become magical people. And it's within our consciousness that we can rise in vibration. Aim ourselves directly for our goals in terms of worshiping and loving the Creator and serving the Creator to the best of our ability. That would be my answer. Guys, what do you think?
Well, it's something I've thought a lot about too, JP, and just it seems I agree with Carla in that there's always a choice. Your brain may offer you a reaction. You might have a fear, some sort of physiological fight or flight reaction, but you can always choose how you interpret what your brain offers you. You still are there. You can be there as a lucid being who chooses how to use the fear that's given to you or how to use the anger that's given to you. But still, I understand what you mean, where it seems like sometimes there's just, like you said, your back's against the wall and your choices are limited, and it's you don't readily see any compassionate way to move forward. And the only way I've really ever been able to make sense of it is to understand the idea that Ross said, we need 51% service to others to graduate from third density. And I don't think it's any mistake that our logos or whatever system is set up gave leeway and that we don't need to be 100% dedicated 100% of the time. We can give ourselves breaks. We can react to a situation in a way that may not be so loving and then look back on it, and we forgive ourselves for it. We figure out why we try to get to the heart of why we did what we did, and maybe next time a situation like that comes up, we do act more loving, but it's not something that I think will keep us from evolving. I don't think that in those rare situations where you just can't see a choice to make any sort of compassionate action, that will keep us from being the divine beings that we truly are, as long as we can look back and think about what we did and forgive ourselves and forgive the situation and accept ourselves and accept the situation. We don't need to be 100% of the time. That's the best that I could come up with for myself and my own answers.
No, I love that answer, and I have a new favorite number. It's 51. So I love the answers. Thanks, guys.
You're very welcome.
Thank you, JP. And JP, I know that you are big into Eckhart Tolle, and Eckhart Tolle has quoted on multiple times the opening to A Course in Miracles, which goes, let's see, nothing real can be threatened, nothing unreal exists, herein lies the peace of God. Do I have that right?
Pretty close, yeah.
I think that's how it goes. And
yeah.
I think that consciousness is available to us, even and especially in tough moments, though it may be the furthest thing from our mind. But I agree with both Austin and Carla and think that you always have the choice to accept the circumstance, even if it feels like your hands are tied behind your back and your choices are constrained and there's nowhere to go, forward, backward, up or down. Acceptance is a choice. Surrender is a choice. Trusting that all is well, no matter how terrible it may seem on the surface, that's a choice too. I think we always, Carla, I think, said it right, that we have that freedom within to choose how we will respond to the moment. Will we respond with courage and lack of fear, or will we, you know, cower down and be afraid and feel threatened? Which is a legitimate response as well, but point being, that attitude is within. And a beautiful, beautiful book that amply examines exactly this question is Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning. And Viktor Frankl was a Jewish individual who was put into a Nazi concentration camp, undergoing the worst possible human experiences and having his choices severely constrained, but nevertheless in that hell discovered a freedom to choose his attitude, to choose his viewpoint, and to choose his focus, no matter how horrible it is on the outside. So if you're interested in exploring the question further, I would definitely recommend that book.
Okay.
Jim,
sounds
did you have a response? I'm sorry, JP. Jim,
no,
did you have
no,
a response
no,
you wanted to offer? We are coming and going.
It's been well said. You guys did a great job. I couldn't add anything.
All right. Does that help, JP?
It helps a lot. Really, really helps give me some peace of mind, because as I seek the Christhood, I mean, sometimes, like I said, you might be forced into really not acting very nicely. And right now I'm not evolved enough to where I can turn the other cheek or just walk away. And I don't want to be a martyr. So it's a very hard thing. But you've given me a lot of peace at this 51. I mean, I'm not going to use it as an excuse to be mean, but it's nice knowing I don't have to.
You get some
somehow.
Yeah,
it sort of relieves the pressure a little bit from having to act a certain way in every single situation. We're humans, and that's all we are. We can't always be perfect.
Yeah. Well,
but
thanks,
Andy,
guys.
Thank you so much for the call. Thanks for always tuning in and supporting. With that, we will say goodbye.
Goodbye.
Farewell.
Cheerio.
And we have another question from area code 360. You are unmuted, 360. With whom do we have the pleasure of speaking?
Oh, my name's Lori.
Hi, Lori.
Hi.
What's your question today?
Well, I don't know. I guess I'm having not a good day. I just feel overwhelmed with things, and I'm dealing with a bad landlord that doesn't want to communicate, and I'm worried about where I'll be living, and I'm just like wondering, you know, how do you pull yourself out of feeling so, how do you pull yourself out of feeling horrible when you're feeling horrible?
A quick caveat, and just to be clear, we don't have clinical training in therapy, nor are we psychics, but we do definitely examine and tackle questions pertaining to living a spiritual life. And Carla herself has experienced lots of things that might be called horrible, and has found a way to relate and to cope and to pull through. Carla, would you like to share any of that part of your own journey?
All right. My own particular journey is easier than yours because the catalyst is physical rather than emotional, and it has to do with being limited. I lost my ability to walk, and I'm losing my ability to see. I don't hear very well. My nose is really good. I've got a great smeller. But, you know, I'm more and more limited. And if I didn't have the best husband in the known universe who take enormously good care of me, I don't know what I'd do. And it's very difficult to keep up one's spirits when there is no way out, you know. So I just do it. I pray. I pray a lot, sweetheart. I depend on the spirit. I depend on my angels. I ask spirit to fill me time and again. It's the one thing that never runs out, never disappoints. Just that moment of breathing, and I can feel the space open within that isn't open on the outside world at all. And I know that all is well, that the Creator offered me these situations, tough as they may seem, so that I might work with them and examine them and find the gifts that are hidden in the pockets of them. There are always gifts. There are things that we can learn, like patience for me and gratitude. I count my blessings a lot. I mean, there are always blessings, even if it's just I can see, you know. I can walk. And things like that. And those are blessings, too. And just start counting your blessings, and your heart starts opening up. If you think about how difficult things are, everything starts shutting down. So the idea is to start expanding your heart and opening your heart and breathing better and letting everything sort of fall down into not so much emotion, more balance, and more appreciation of the good in life that we do have. And it may not last very long, and so then you do it over. And then you do it over. And then guess what? You do it over. You just keep repeating this. And every once in a while, you go to sleep, and you can just, you know, dream away and not be there for a while, and then you wake up and here it is again, and so you deal with it again.
Yeah.
I don't know if that helps at all, but it's the way I work with my catalyst to keep myself cheerful and good company and not bring other people down, you know, with my problems. And really, just in the process of counting my blessings over and over, all the people in my life are so good to me, and it's overwhelming. Once I catch on to that and am, you know, praising the Creator for the beauty of that, then I'm safe. I'm good. Good to go. Anybody else, please? I'm sure that my answer is not particularly helpful.
That's
helpful. You know, depending on...
That's very helpful.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm so glad.
Yeah.
I'm so very glad.
Yeah, I could relate to that.
Yeah, Lori, it's impossible for us to speak to the outer circumstances per se, whether with a landlord or finances or job, et cetera. But we are people devoted to our own path and who are working on an interior level with our own consciousness. And the state of mind that it seems you're experiencing is, like Carla was describing, one that is focused on difficulty, and that creates an energetic contraction. From my limited understanding, it boxes you inside to a very tight space. It seems to limit you, and out of that arises fear and panic and anxiety and oh my God, oh my God, oh my God.
Yeah.
And that can feed on itself. But everything Carla is describing, which has been helpful in applying to my own problems and my own difficulties, is involves a shift in attitude, a shift in how you perceive your catalyst and how you respond to it. And a few of the tools that Carla mentioned includes praying and counting your blessings and focusing on that which is right and that which is good and trusting that all is well. That's a hard. That's why it's a leap of faith, because there seems to be no evidence outside of you that says all is well. Everything may appear to be crap on the outside, but nevertheless, you jump into midair, you jump into the unknown, and say, "I'm just going to trust that all is well. I'm going to accept this." And I think a lot of the circumstances may still be challenging outside of you, but I think a lot of the suffering that you experience is a refusal to believe that all is well. It's that contraction that I was describing. It's resistance. You're resisting your life circumstances and saying, no, 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 it can't be this way. I don't want it to be this way, et cetera. And like I said, I think that creates pain and that distance between what is actually happening in your life and what you're feeling inside. That's my inadequate response.
That's about right. I just have to try to change my mindset.
The one thing I would have to add to what Gary and Carla would say is that even though sometimes you understand this is what you need to do, that perception is causing this sort of feedback loop of negativity happening in your mind, it's not so easy to always just change your mind. And praying, like Carla was saying, can help. If you repeat a prayer, that can sort of help to relieve the cycle of negativity that keeps reinforcing itself. But sometimes it's just really hard to break this cycle. That it's like there's an energy in your mind that is just reinforcing itself, and it's spinning and spinning and spinning. And finding out a way to stop that spinning negativity in your mind can be difficult. And some things, like really deep breathing, just breathing deep, hold it in for 2 seconds, and releasing it. And if that doesn't work, you could even try sometimes what works for some people is making really exaggerated noises as you exhale, like a really loud sigh, or just make any kind of noise as you exhale. And that kind of works to help release the energy that's building up inside of you, and it sort of gets released in these funny noises that you're making. And sometimes you even start laughing at yourself for being so funny, and everything just sort of releases. Things like that, or if there's a way to just temporarily get your mind off of it and just absorb yourself in something else. If I'm feeling like I have a situation going on that I just can't get my mind off of, no matter how much I'm meditating, no matter how much I'm breathing, I'll try to go and immerse myself in a completely different environment. I'll go take a walk through the woods and just pay attention to all of the trees and listen to the birds and listen to the bugs. I'll go and watch a movie, go to a movie theater by myself where it's just completely dark and, like, the only thing you can see in front of you is this story unfolding with characters and events that have nothing to do with you, and you can just release this. And once you're done with the movie, you've calmed down, the energy has stopped spinning, and then you can maybe start to look at a different perception on what you're dealing with. That's the only other thing I would have to add.
Mick, how about you? I know that you've dealt with situations like this. What do you do?
Well, your idea of focusing on what is positive and what you really have as blessings, I think, is a great place to start with building a foundation for changing the way that you look at things. And then eventually you can get another step along the way, and that is to begin to deal with the difficult areas by finding some little positive thing in that area that you can expand upon. I remember when you were telling me, Carl, about the first job you got at Speed Scientific School as a librarian.
Yeah.
You had to work with this lady who was very unlikable. In fact, the guy that hired you was hoping that you could take her place.
That's right. He wanted me to make her so mad that she'd leave.
Right. And instead, you decided you're going to act toward her as if you really did care for her, as if you really loved her. And after a period of time, what was it, a couple of months?
It was a couple of weeks, actually, is all it took.
You discovered that you really did have loving feelings for this person, that there were some really good points about her that you'd gotten to know and that you could build on that, and you really did care about her. And I had a similar experience last year doing the same thing with another person, and it worked. I'm really glad to say that if you put some energy there, you know, kind of like seed your own mind with the positive viewpoint, it seems to grow, because the positivity really is born through reflection of our reality. Even though we have difficulties to go through, we've got all kinds of blessings with which to do that. So if we can seed our mind with some positive ideas and build on that, then I think we've got a way of dealing with what's difficult.
Okay.
All right. Is that
Yeah, that helps a lot. Thank you.
Well, it's a blessing to talk to you.
Well, thank you,
Colin.
Thank you. Thanks for talking to me.
And thank you, Laurie, and God bless on everything that you're facing right now and in the near future.
Thank you.
We wish you well.
Thank you.
All right. We have a few questions that were sent in advance, and two of those are actually from JP.
Thank you, JP. He's a very, very good questioner.
He is. So, well, let's see. 20 minutes to the end of the show. I think we'll ask one from JP and then one from Sandra. That might be the show. So JP asks, according to most sources, on what level or density is the ego usually given up and we truly begin to act and live as we, comma, us, comma, the oneness?
Well, I don't like the term ego, and I don't think that the Rog material would tolerate Don's using the term either. Ego is another word. It's like a shorthand term for a situation in which your emotions are running the show. and you are doing things for an emotional reason, like you're trying to get credit for something, you're trying to get people to like you, or you're trying to control people, or it's not really oriented to a density. It's oriented more to a chakra. I'd say it's a yellow chakra situation in which the solution is a release into the green ray chakra, the one next on the ladder up, which is the open heart. So it's that would be where I would put the ego as such, not liking the term very well. Who can answer better than I can? I'm a little stuck on not liking the term.
Well, I completely agree that the term, it's just been sort of abused. People can say ego and mean lots of different things. Like you were saying, Ra themselves, they said, we cannot work with this concept as it is misapplied and understanding cannot come from it. So Ra themselves didn't like using it, even though they did use the term later to describe a couple of things. It's just not a very good term to work with. And something I learned recently, ego, as we understand it, is based upon Freud's conceptualization of the psyche. And ego, in that sense, means I. And Freud actually, in his native language, used the actual word I. He used ich. And whoever was translating Freud thought that it would be fancier to use the Latin term instead of the English term. So if they had translated it properly, everything that Freud talked about in regards to ego would actually just mean I. It wouldn't sound like some fancy term for some abstract psychological concept. It would be much more relatable. And this is much more what Freud intended when he created the term ego. And so when people talk about somebody might have like an overinflated sense of ego, maybe they feel like their sense of I is overinflated, that they feel like they themselves are overimportant, or they feel they are overimportant. And I think that this does relate to what JP is saying, because JP asks, when we begin to act like we or us, which initially seems like it's at odds with the idea of I, when instead of acting as I, we act as we or we act as us. But from what I understand, is we don't necessarily ever give up our I-ness. We never give up our ego in that sense. We only allow it to expand to greater and greater identification. It's often said that the most primal thought in the universe is I am, and that all that there is I am. And in this sense, if I means ego, then basically what that's saying is all there is ego, like ultimately is one big ego. So what I think happens, and what I think might answer JP's question a little better, is that in fourth density, we merge our sense of I or I-ness with other individuals' sense of I. And that might be what JP is looking for, is in fourth density, we kind of decide to act as a we, but we're not necessarily giving up our sense of I. We're not giving up our sense of ego when we do decide to act as a social memory complex. If we gave up our sense of I, we would sort of be returning back to second density, because that's what second density was. Second density has a complete identity with the pack or the world around us. Second density animal does not recognize an I as distinct from anything else. But that's what we evolved from, and we're not trying to get back to second density. So I think that when we go to fourth density and form the collective social memory complex, we retain our sense of I, and we just merge it with other individual sense of I, other egos. And so while we still retain our ego includes other people's egos as well.
Fascinating. Thanks a lot for that. I did not know that.
Thank you.
Jim, how about you?
Don't think I can add anything extra to the ego. I can't work with it either.
What density it is or anything about it?
Well, I'm pretty sure it's stuck in third density. I doubt if there's anything even resembles the ego or anybody tries to describe ego above the third density. And I don't think I have any idea of ego, so I guess it's going to be a third density phenomenon. One of the many that we have to get beyond.
I've had a relationship to that word for a little while, and have focused on Ra saying that it's misapplied. That I think necessarily implies that there is a proper application for the word ego. It's
mm-hmm.
just that our culture does not properly apply it whatsoever. It's so thoroughly and so across the board is it misapplied that Ra wouldn't even work with it. And I think if there is a right use for it, it's synonymous with what the Confederation and the conscious channeling calls the personality shell.
Mm-hmm.
The teaching of Ramana Maharshi uses actually that word ego on that same level. Eckhart Tolle likewise. And in that light, in that meaning, I think ego has a use if it's intended to mean basically the false self, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way. And I say
a mask, you're saying.
Yeah, the mask, the outer shallow self. That's the most illusory aspect of the personality. And on that level, it makes sense to me. And if that's the way that JP intends it, then.
Well, it's something to consider.
Yeah. I would think third density is the most veiled, the most illusory, the most vivid. So it's here that naturally and necessarily that sort of surface illusory identity will arise. It will have less support in fourth density and even less in fifth and so on and so forth. But maybe one can make a case that to the extent that there is any sort of individuality, even if it's a social memory complex individuality, if an entity perceives that it exists and has this personal history and personal identity, then maybe that is still some kind of clinging on to an illusory identity that persists. Maybe that is, like Austin was describing, the evolution of ego. Maybe that's a higher form of ego that, yes, is in touch with, unified with, communing with the all, but still for some reason retains its form, its shape, its shell. Ra even, I think, mentions something about their, you know, moving into the foreverness of seventh density, but they still
retain their sense of self.
Yeah, that was the basic mm-hmm. gist of it. So that's my thoughts on that question. Does anybody have anything else to offer that one?
No, I'm done, thank you.
All right.
And last but not least.
Sandra's question is long in reading, but I won't have a response. Did you have a response to Sandra's, Austin?
I mean, I could probably address something. She addresses it to Carla, though, I believe, doesn't she?
Yeah.
Well, go ahead and hit it, and we'll see what we can do.
All right. We're usually really expert at, like, closing the show right at the same time, on the mark. So, Sandra's question via email is, my question is about Jesus. I have heard you, Carla, speak so sweetly about Jesus and your personal experience with him. I, too, had a personal encounter with Jesus, yet I now struggle with his authenticity, or better yet, his purpose or intention. I was raised a Christian, but I tell people my religion is eclectic with a concentration in spirituality. My father, a student of the Coptic Christian Hamad Bey, presented me with metaphysical thoughts as a very young child of 5 or 6, and opened up my mind as a seeker of higher thoughts and consciousness since then. I have read or heard many conflicting accounts of Jesus over the years and have never felt that they had any influence on my belief of him, whether they be correct or incorrect. However, several very prominent people whom I respect for their research and integrity have claimed that Jesus was part of the whole plan of deception by the, quote, off-world beings that keep our planet in a prison of fear and control, the ones who rule and manipulate the Illuminati here on Earth, the real guys in charge, she adds in parentheses. Their plan was to have Jesus become a, quote, savior and create a Christian dogma that would keep people in bondage and guilt-ridden and provide reasons for fighting religious wars throughout the centuries. This possibility has disturbed me beyond all words. Talk about the dark night of the soul. I have been in the spiritual crisis for some time now. I certainly don't want to buy into or support those beings who are creating such havoc on our planet. Yet I feel sacrilegious even questioning Jesus' real identity and purpose. Do you have any thoughts about what these very vocal speakers have suggested about Jesus?
Well, I certainly do. Just to put it very simply, Jesus himself was very clear on the point of wanting control. He said, put away your sword. My kingdom is not of this world. Always he talked about inclusiveness, bringing everybody in. If you do this to the least of these, my brothers, you do it to me. See the face of Christhood everywhere you go. Know that all beings are holy. This was Jesus' take. And he wouldn't even judge a woman in terms of his culture, who was, in terms of his culture, a bad woman. She was a prostitute. And she deserved, according to that culture, to be stoned. That is, to be put to death by throwing stones at her until something broke. And he said, let he who is without sin the first stone. And everybody looked at everybody else and, and, you know, cleared their throats and shuffled because everybody had done something wrong along the way. Nobody was without sin. Nobody had the right to judge. And so the woman walked away. And Jesus forgave the thief on the cross next to him when he was dying. He said, this day you will be with me in paradise. You know, I realize that you're a thief in this life. I realize you murdered in this life. But in the next life, everybody in. That was his way of thinking. Now, others may have manipulated the Jesus myth that surrounded the Jesus reality to convince large numbers of people, which they have, which they did, which is ongoing as we speak. The politics of Christianity is horrible. It's absolutely horrible. You get involved in that, and yes, you will be so depressed. It'll be the dark night of the week. I mean, forget it, man. It's just awful. And when I hit that for the first time in college, I was desperately unhappy about that. But what are you going to do but cling to the Jesus that is, the authentic Jesus, the one who loved so much that he forgave all, and just attempt to serve that love? That would be my suggestion. And I think I made it within the time so that we can keep our schedule, Gary. If anybody else has anything to say on that, please have at it. But that would be my response, sweetheart.
Just really quickly, Sandra, you're saying that you really trust these people that are saying that Jesus was intentionally placed here to manipulate and control. You had a relationship with a different Jesus that was not placed here to manipulate and control, and you saw Jesus in a different light. And Jesus was a real person, that is true, and I believe that, I don't necessarily believe what these people are saying that you believe, but either way, we're looking at a symbol rather than a literal person when we work with the concept of Jesus. We are looking at, as Carla was saying, the representation of what Jesus did in these stories, this preaching love and forgiveness and acceptance. And I think that's what's more important than any literal depiction of Jesus like these people are offering you, and that I don't think that their description of what they believe Jesus was should necessarily affect the symbol that is important to you. If the symbol of Jesus has served you in your spiritual path, then I would continue to allow that symbol to serve you in your spiritual path, because I don't think that would be the same thing as the Jesus that these people would be talking about.
Yeah, I didn't think I had a response, but listening to Austin, it occurs to me that like Jesus has been invoked for every cause, the whole ranging from the whole spectrum, from very positive to very negative. And I definitely resonate with and agree with Carla's interpretation of who Jesus is and what he represented. I think that's authentic to me, at least. But there are, with a figure like him, and anybody on that level is going to be interpreted in a million different lights. So, you, like Austin was saying, you have to find the one that resonates with you.
You know, listen to that still small voice that is within you that has resonated so clearly and frequently in the past as to the nature of Jesus, and let that be your source.
I think that you have to trust your own discrimination above anybody else's judgment. Yours is good for you, whatever anybody else thinks.
And with that, we'll wrap things up. It's probably a little bit too late to tell you about our homecoming because it kicks off in 3 days. But you're driving through Louisville, Kentucky, and have nothing on your schedule from Friday through Sunday. Drop us an email and register
we'll
for
you
our
in.
Yeah. We'll have good food, good people, and we'll meet to in a circle. Outdoors, centered around a mandala, a flower mandala that Jim just built out of flower and stone and earth. And we will share our hearts with one another, focused on our spiritual seeking. So, Carla, would you like to say goodbye to...
I would. We love you so much, everybody. We love you all. And thank you so much, those of you who wrote questions. And please write more. We need them. We're still a bit low on questions, and heaven knows, without your questions, I'm not sure what we would talk about. Help! Okay, Gary, do the outro.
Thank you, Carla. You've been listening to LL Research's In the Now Q&A with Carla and crew. If you've enjoyed the show, please visit our websites, llresearch.org and bringforth.org. Thanks so much for listening, and a special thank you to those who submitted questions, JP, Sandra, and Lori. Lori, I just want to say one more time that you have what it takes to meet the the circumstances of your life, and we send you love and light. If you'd like to submit a question for us before the next show, please read the instructions on our page at blogtalkradio.com/LLResearch. Have a wonderful week. We'll be here next Tuesday at 1 – I'm sorry, we'll be here next Thursday, September 4th at 1 p.m. Eastern. Talk with you then. We love you, everybody.
I lay alone in Allen Coast, and only so that I see a ghost. I run through a wooded aisle and chase the sunlight mile after mile. And I feel like I know this place, and a tree line breaks in the wide open space. I stare at a bright red sun, search all day and never find anyone. I walk on a winding road, deep in the night, near the edge of the known. I pass by moonlit lake, cold wind blows and my bones start to shake. And I feel I should know this place, there's a road winds on in a wide open space. The wind plays a haunting tone and I make my way through the night all alone. Well, I've been dreaming again of a life I know, but I'm lost and gone. playing its turn, and the old